Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 4th of August, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. We'll also be joined today by David Scott with Northern Exposure. Deployment and wind is probably the start of today, Mike.
Well, certainly hot air. So the UK Maritime Forces have completed their latest French naval deployment, Brian, because, of course, since the 2010 Lancaster House treaties, we are in a 50-year defence pact. I did laugh the other day when I saw a statement from President Macron saying, you know, Britain, even after Brexit, Britain and France would be, you know, a really close military relationship. Well, because he has no choice. He's in a 50-year defence pact and he can't get out of it.
Absolutely true, Mike. But they're making a big noise over a deployment of 2 helicopters and 70 personnel.
Absolutely, because through the 2010 Lancaster House treaties, Brian, the UK and France are continuing to strengthen an even closer bilateral defence and security relationship. So we've got to take every opportunity to promote these joint actions. Now, there was so these 2 helicopters on this on FS Mistral were taking part with other ships, including Jeanne d'Arc, and they also included port calls in Singapore, Sri Lanka, Vietnam, Japan, Guam, Australia, and Egypt, as well as various multinational amphibious exercises. So it's all very exciting, but the point here is that the military union carries on apace.
Yeah, yes, we've got the added net around everything at the moment, that we've got these bilateral agreements as alongside anything that's to do with the European Union. And of course, if we look at that report, the other thing they said is, what are they doing? Well, they're practicing anti-piracy operations. We've still got the position that apparently those pirates can outclass the American Navy, the EU military forces, and combined might of Britain and the French, if you believe it.
Yes, if. Okay, let's move on to Grenfell Tower. Of course, we've been talking about this, or we've been showing the advertising video, that this is the final day for inquiry submissions. Apparently, more than 200 written submissions have been received by Sir Martin Moore-Bick. Of course, he's the retired judge who's going to be sort of leading this inquiry if it takes place, because there's already some discussion in the media about whether the inquiry will happen, at least immediately, because they're saying it could be suspended if criminal charges are brought by the police because of what might be considered a potential for conflict with the public inquiry. So already they're trying to sort of ease it back a little bit, it seems. Well, Sir Martin, of course, doesn't exactly hold the confidence of the community. He gave the appearance at a recent public meeting of being upset by the fact that he was doubted by local people. So we wait to see what the scope of this inquiry turns out to be and whether the pressure that he's been under from the local community bears fruit. In the meantime, the BBC this morning, Brian, was speaking to Emma Dent Code, who's the local MP. Let's just listen to a little bit of this, because frankly, I was slightly speechless, almost.
I'm not surprised, Mike. Not surprised.
So let's listen.
Listening to that, Emma Dent Code is the Labour MP for Kensington and was a councillor in the area. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Now, you described Sir Martin as a technocrat. You said he lacked credibility with the victims. You called on him to stand down. Do you still argue that?
Well, it's a bit late to, we've got to work with a system that we have, unfortunately. I still don't have total confidence. Further people have been brought in to advise him and back him up, the whole legal team. Some of them, I think, have been speaking to all the various groups and probably have a little bit more confidence. So I think that has improved slightly.
Is it not your responsibility, though, as a Member of Parliament, to tell people, the residents, why they should trust a judge rather than merely echoing their anger?
Absolutely not. My job is, as an MP, is to represent their concerns, not to tell them what to do. That's the last thing I should be doing.
Well,
especially
maybe not
now.
Tell them what to do, but you might say, well, look, I've looked into this judge. I've looked at what he's doing. I am told that he's a trustworthy figure. Otherwise, don't you ensure that people in a year's time or 2 years' time or whenever it is will simply say it's a whitewash?
No, I take my cue from the people who elected me, and that's how I've always worked. Actually, I'm their mediator, not the government or the inquiries mediator.
Mediator or echo chamber?
Well, I would say mediator, because you know, obviously we have been working with all the different parties, and I've met them quite a few times, and we've been trying to work with what we have.
So, Brian, frankly, I don't even know where to start with that. So this seems to me to be the BBC giving an MP instructions for what. Now, I realise MPs don't have a formal job specification, but and I realise that we have been over the last year or two criticising many MPs for being exactly that, a representative of corporate interests, of party interests, putting the interests of their careers before their constituents. But here is a woman who is clearly decided that her role is to represent her constituents. And the BBC is telling her, no, you don't want to be representing your constituents. You want to be representing the chairman of the inquiry to your constituents.
That expression, responsibility as an MP to tell the people to trust a judge.
Yeah.
I mean, this is astounding. The BBC, with the usual arrogance, telling an MP what she should be doing, which is supporting the government and telling people they should trust judges. I think I'll stop there at the moment. Probably should bring David in.
Yeah, let's bring David Scott in. Welcome to the programme. What's your position on this?
It was remarkable. There's the BBC. They're saying that the MPs have essentially a propaganda role to persuade the public that there's nothing to worry about, everything's fine. I mean, just
it's breathtaking,
just unbelievable. And they're arguing with the MP who's saying her job's a mediator, which amongst other things means honest broker. Well, yeah, we don't want any of those in the public realm, do we?
Yeah,
on the BBC.
Do we think those questions came from the BBC? Was that from the reporter himself, or was he told what questions he should be across?
I think that was from Nick Robinson himself. I think he is quite capable of holding that view of the world and presenting it.
Yeah, and the derogatory remark that perhaps she was an echo chamber for what her constituents were saying. So these peasants have got some view which is utterly irrelevant, and you're being an echo chamber for them. It really is time, David, that we in the widest sense took on the BBC. This is a truly appalling organisation. And Mike covered the actions of BBC's charity, BBC Media Action, a couple of days ago. This is not independent news in any shape or form. This is just another arm of the British government and is as corrupt in every form.
It's the underlying assumption that the ordinary people are somehow less. That, you must be deferential to your betters, to those in authority, irrespective of what logic would dictate, irrespective of argument, irrespective of any valid concerns you may have, because, well, you're just an ordinary person and it's just an echo chamber and there's nothing of any sense going to come from that. We really need to listen and believe what we're told from on high. This is the mindset, and I don't think anyone's taking BBC journalists aside and said this is the party line. This is just something that is now believed.
Yeah, absolutely. David, let's have a look at Dubai, because once again, we have one of these types of fires. So this is the Torch Tower, ironically named. And this looks very similar to Grenfell.
It does indeed. I mean, there you see the fire rain falling. This is from composite cladding material. How similar it is to the Grenfell cladding, I'm not entirely sure as yet, but it's an aluminium composite. It does have thermoplastic type materials within it. So it sounds, at least superficially, very similar to the Grenfell cladding. Here you see the same issues, debris raining down. You see large pieces of burning cladding falling. You see the small kind of fire rain elements falling down, which is melted plastic cores from composite panels. And you see the disastrous and very rapid fire spread vertically up the building, so you see everything you saw at Grenfell once again.
Two remarkable differences here. First of all, everybody got out. And the other thing was that the fire service was able to put this fire out within a couple of hours, it seems. So access is clearly a lot better to this building than there was to Grenfell Tower. I think that was a large part of the fire service's problem at Grenfell. But this is a much larger building as well. So clearly because it was not social housing, it probably had some kind of fire suppression on the inside.
This is a very large building. When this was built, it was the largest residential building on the face of the planet, and it's still about number 40 in terms of high rises anywhere on the face of the earth. Modern building. There was a serious fire back in 2015 in the same building, which again spread rapidly to the top and again was fought very effectively and put out very rapidly from the inside. And yes, much better access, much better escape. Social housing, no, it's $450,000 a flat, I understand.
Yes. Okay, let's move on to Scottish issues. David and Ardis Air. Now, just before we start talking about this, could you just remind people once again, just briefly, what this is about?
Yes, Ardis Air is a long-running dispute between a community and a developer and powerful interests serving the developer, including the local authority, and Scottish Water. This is decided. It's been decided to put large sewage treatment works into this village to serve an adjacent town, new town, which is going to be created. The village don't want this, and the decision seems to be made in very doubtful circumstances, where the choice of various sites was suddenly reversed, and the least appropriate site became the one that was selected, and the village got no real role in any sort of public scrutiny of the decision or of input into it. So there was a lot of ill feeling. The work started. There's been quite a number of disputes along the way as the works come through the village. But through a mixture of, as far as I can tell, ignorance and arrogance, the developer and their agent, Scottish Water, have not purchased some of the land they need to put a pipe through, or they've not sought permission from the owners of the land to put this pipe through. And they were deciding they were just going to charge ahead. So they were putting enormous pressure on the owners of the land, on the community, to allow this to proceed because Scottish Water say so, not because there's been negotiations, discussions, proper interaction between free people in a common law jurisdiction.
So this resolution of any problem, David, and an agreement. Sorry, David, this riding roughshod over the community is quite similar to what the community in Grenfell has been experiencing.
It's very similar. It's very interesting to see it up close and personal, because what happens is arguments that are made are just ignored. Right? The community makes a good argument, and it's like they never opened their mouths. It just vanishes. There's no response. There's no engagement. It's just like they never said anything. And then pressure comes on. Now, what we've been through this week, at the end of last week, we discovered that the Scottish Water had gone to the local court. They'd gone to the lowest court, the JP court in Inverness, and they had applied for a warrant to gain access to this land, including using force. So here this is two families, one of whom has seven disabled people constituting the family. So they run to the court and they say, well, we want a warrant and we want to be able to use force to enter this land. And they tell the court that they don't know who owns the land, and they've tried to find out and they can't. And they don't, it would appear, tell the court that there are two families here sitting with title deeds who have declared quite clearly that they own the land and that there's nobody else claiming it. There's no conflict. There's no competing claims. All of this seems to be not disclosed to the court. And they walk away with a warrant. And a few days later, they serve this and they start to threaten people with being charged for obstruction. Now, what's then happened is the people of Ardis Air have kind of rallied to the support of these two families. There's lots of vehicles parked on the land. There's lots of people occupying the land. And any time Scottish Water turned up, the call was going out and many more people were coming down to be on the land so that Scottish Water could not just force their way through, bully boy tactic, and start to carry out this work irrespective of the wishes of the landowners. So this is what's been going on, and it got quite tense up in Ardersier this week as people were threatened with being charged, and the response was, "We're not moving. You charge me if you like. This is private land, and Scottish Water are behaving unlawfully." So here you see, this is the Scottish Law Reporter has tweeted out the a copy of the warrant that was issued by the court, and you'll see it's a bit scrappy. There's notes in the margin, and there's crossed out, and there's bits added in, and when it comes time to put the Justice of the Peace's name in it, it's left blank. It's a strange-looking document, even on the face of it. And you see that was tweeted to, amongst other, Fergus Ewing MSP, who was one of several politicians asked to get involved, and he did. He wrote to the chief executive of Scottish Water, and there was a response, and he let the family have a response, and there was a reply to that, which outlined many very serious areas of concern, and Fergus Ewing wrote again to the Scottish Water chief executive, and suggested that coercive measures, forcing the thing through, carrying out the work without permission of the landowners, and all of this was not the right way to do business in Scotland, and that some form of discussion could should be carried out instead. Now, discussions had been refused by the developer only a week ago. They weren't interested in talking to the landowners. They weren't interested in talking to the community. They weren't interested in talking to ourselves. We are representing one of the landowners. Now, with a combination of coverage in the press, people on site willing to sacrifice to stand up for the law, political pressure, and the fact that underlying it all, Scottish Water have no case, there seems to be a point where they blinked this week, and all of a sudden we're now going into negotiations. So we seem to be having a little bit of sense coming in. That last slide there, that was a piece from the Nairnshire. So this is a view of some of the community policemen there, just working at an extremely peaceful sit-in on the land, with vehicles and with people in tents and a lot of smiles. And it was all done in a very good-natured way. It was all done extremely peacefully. It was all done with the support of the local community policemen. They were quite happy because it was peaceful. So they didn't have any problem with it. But there was many background bits of political pressure going on. But we seem to be making some progress. So it's a combination of community standing together, acting lawfully, acting peacefully, getting the message out, using the press, using the politicians, using the legal route, because they eventually got a lawyer, and he was at least intending to launch a legal challenge through the courts if sense didn't prevail. So there was a whole series of avenues that were followed to actually resist this aggression. And at least for the moment, it seems that we're making some progress, and there'll be further discussions, and we'll keep you advised of developments.
Okay, super, super. Now, another case that we've been following with you over the last several months has been the case of Sean Ritchie. Again, just give us a brief background as to who he is, and you know, is he and of course he's still missing.
Sean Ritchie is officially missing. Everybody who knows anything about the case believes he's dead, including his parents. He disappeared on Guy Fawkes night. Not Guy Fawkes night, Halloween, beg your pardon. He disappeared on Halloween, and he was never seen again. Some of his clothes were recovered, but no sign of him. Sean Ritchie's mother is quite clear who the suspects are, and there are many things which are just bizarre about the case. The policemen involved, and Peter Head, the policemen involved are all policemen that we know from the Doherty investigation. One of the people that is suspected by the family has been responsible for Sean's death, and they assure it's a murder, not a missing person, has in fact been charged for an axe-related assault on another member of the party that same night. And the police say that this has nothing to do with Sean's disappearance, an absolutely outrageous and impossible thing to believe. But that charge is never coming to court. It's constantly deferred.
Yeah.
So what's happening up there? We don't know. So what's this story is, there's two interesting aspects to this. One, there's pressure put on his mother. I haven't yet managed to speak to her, so I don't know her side of this particular part of the story, to admit that calls which were coming in threatening Sean Rich's family to stop campaigning for justice were made by her and were wasting police time. Now, I've spoken to her about this. I do not believe that. I do not believe that for a moment that that's true. The police, however, seem to, and they were putting pressure on her. Now, the last I heard, they were putting such pressure on that if it went to trial and they got a conviction on this wasting police time charge, they would then be coming after her over Sean's disappearance, right? Which is absolutely outrageous. There's no evidence, but that's what she was told. She was put under enormous personal pressure. This is someone with enormous issues. She's got some mental health problems, not least of which are caused by the loss of her son. And this was the level of threat that was being levelled against her. Absolutely outrageous.
Yeah.
Now, the other, just before I leave this, the other interesting thing is that trial was due to be on the 24th of August. I was planning to be there to see what was going on and report on it for the UK column. Now, it's now reported what's happening in inner discussions with the fiscal, and it's reported in the Press and Journal. This is the second time this has happened, that where the fiscal and the Scottish authorities want to get information out to suit their position, they are using the Press and Journal as their house organ to get this information into the public domain. The Press and Journal, the sixth oldest newspaper in the world, doesn't seem to have any critical thinking facilities left to actually ask the questions that are demanded of this or get the other side of the story. It's very disappointing.
Yeah, unfortunately, we seem to be seeing that right across the mainstream media at the moment. Right, let's move on to economic issues, financial issues. The International Monetary Fund has issued a new brief. It's called Negative Interest Rate Policies, Initial Experiences and Assessments. And they say the depth of the crisis is a 2008 crisis they're talking about. The depth of the crisis and the weakness of the ensuing recovery led to new ways of implementing monetary policy. At the onset of the crisis, central banks in several advanced economies quickly moved policy rates to zero and initiated large-scale asset purchases. In more recent years, with inflation still below target and limited support from fiscal policy, several central banks lowered their policy rates below the previous zero lower bound, embarking on so-called negative interest rate policies. This paper explores the implications of negative interest rate policies for monetary policy, transmission and banks' behaviour. And what they're particularly concerned about here, David, is that people might start to hoard cash in a negative interest rate world. So they are concerned particularly about the value of highest denomination banknotes, because these are the banknotes that people will hoard cash in. And they say that the physical space required for storing, for example, $1 million, US dollars equivalent, would be similar in Japan and the USA, but lower in the Eurozone and in Switzerland, where the higher denomination notes are larger values. So what they're then saying is suspending issuance of larger denomination notes would increase the cost of using cash as a store of value and presumably allow for more negative rate. So they are suggesting that perhaps the best thing to do if they need to pursue lower negative interest rates is to stop issuing large denomination banknotes, effectively withdraw them from circulation, and therefore persuade people not to hoard cash. And then the other thing that they discuss is theoretical schemes for taxing cash holdings, although they say that these are probably impractical because they couldn't get the political will for that. It would reduce the effectiveness of such schemes, this lack of political will. So this is quite an incredible paper, David, and yet another attack on cash.
And on reality. I mean, nothing real. There's nothing real in that. The view that modern macroeconomics may be summarised with the phrase blah, blah, blah is becoming ever more accurate. It's just one piece of illogical nonsense piled upon another, and it, pretending to be economic analysis and banking policy. It's just outrageous. Now, a couple of quick comments. Money is a free market phenomenon. Money emerges in any market condition. Up until recently, cigarettes used to be money in prison because it was the most desirable, tradable good. So if they attack money in one area, then there'll simply be a transfer of the role of money to something else. It'll be cars, it'll be paintings, it'll be something else, because there's always going to be a free market response. I would suggest to people that they consider seriously buying gold and silver.
Yep. Okay. I mean, fair enough.
Yes. I was just going to interject there. When we went to visit the Grenville Tower community, we stayed in a hotel and we witnessed some Australian tourists who were unable to pay with a card. And in our chat box, I'm not quite sure who's posted that. I think maybe Alex Thompson said that also they were refused change for a 100 euro note at a bureau de change somewhere.
Yes, so this attack on cash continues.
It's real.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's look at the cybersecurity area. And most of the mainstream media, I've chosen the Telegraph here, most of the mainstream media covering the issue of what's happened to Marcus Hutchins. Now, this is the young guy who provided the solution to the WannaCry virus, which was attacking the National Health Service so badly. He went off to the United States over the last few days to take part in a cybersecurity conference. And as he was leaving the US, he was arrested at the airport, Sin City Airport. Of course, that's Las Vegas Airport, on his way back to the UK. He's now held by the FBI. The whole thing is quite strange. Now, at the time, there were some questions as to what was the source of the WannaCry virus, and some people were suggesting that perhaps it had originated with the security services. Do they have some vendetta to pursue here? It's not clear. And the reason that I ask that is because, as other people have pointed out, on the day that the Kronos virus, which is the one that he is accused by the FBI of having written, on the day that that virus sort of became public, or there was some public discussion of it, he was tweeting this out, asking, has anybody got a sample? And the question that in many people's minds is, why would the author of a virus be tweeting out for a copy of the virus? Because, of course, what this guy is doing is analysing viruses. That's why he was able to comment on the WannaCry situation. So many questions on this. And, of course, the other question that that the Register, amongst others, were asking was, they were raising the issue of why he was being arrested while he was in the United States, because, of course, Britain and the US have a very favourable extradition situation, and that's thanks to Tony Blair bending over forwards to accommodate George Bush. So it seems strange, many people asking why they waited for him to go to the US before they arrested him, rather, if they had evidence, rather than simply asking for pursuing an extradition process. So the question is, do they have evidence? Well, a grand jury in the United States has indicted him. He hasn't yet been arraigned, but we'll see how this pursues. But there's many, many questions over this case.
The whole sense of it is dirty.
Absolutely. Now, in the US, the issue over Russiagate continues, and a new dimension to it, Brian, because as you know, there are various treaties in place with Russia, particularly with regards to nuclear non-proliferation. And one of them is the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, so-called INF Treaty. That was signed between Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev. Well, Congress is now pursuing the notion through the National Defense Authorization Act, this is the budget, which has to be renewed, the defense budget, so this is for the fiscal year 2018. So through that, they are pursuing the idea that perhaps the US should just forget about the INF Treaty and start investing in short and medium range land-based cruise nuclear missiles. again, this is another attempt, it seems, to attack Trump's moves to get closer to Russia, and particularly dangerous one at that.
It's becoming quite nasty, Mike. And perhaps we come straight in with this one, which is the BBC headline that a grand jury is going to be used in the Trump-Russia investigation. And I was just interested in the way that the BBC put this across, because at one point they start telling us what a grand jury is, composed of members of the public who hear evidence in secret. In fact, the fact some parts of it are held behind a closed door. This is reinforced. It's secret. There'll be no disclosure. But what we're really talking about here is a part of common law.
Yes.
Which is a very good part of it, which is that we've got members of the public considering evidence and deciding whether it's going to go forward to a trial by jury. But this is all made as though it's quite dark. It's secret stuff. And of course, it's all targeted at Trump. And there's no evidence at the moment, but this is where the article ends, on the trail of something big. And so now the BBC, having said, well, there isn't any evidence at the beginning of the article, is telling us that this is really moving into big, deep territory, and they are really going for Trump. Just like to add that if you want to read up on the all-important Constitution and common law, and of course this is where that part of American law has come from, have a look at the British Constitution Group website. There's also a very good article by John Hurst, Whatever Happened to Grand Juries? And we're particularly keen to promote this subject because, of course, we believe that together with Article 61, this gives us a proper route to redress in Britain now that we're being told that we should simply accept a judge in a court behind closed doors, deciding whatever that judge wants to do, including taking our children. And on that note, and on the BBC again, we picked up on this one, which was that they were crowing there'd been glitches with a key free childcare website, and it was being probed. So Nicky Morgan, who now chairs the Treasury Committee, has demanded answers from the boss of Revenue and Customs, which runs the website. So I was just intrigued that we have Revenue and Customs now mixed up with the provision of childcare. And if you do have a look at that website, you'll see that one of the sections invites you to give them information on yourself and your circumstances so that they can help choose what sort of childcare services you need. Don't get a lot of confidence from that. Somebody else who's on the case of what's happening with the with children is the Campaign for Real Education. Now, we've been aware of this organisation for some time, and they've really stayed on the case. So they are warning about progressive philosophies which are changing the face of education. If you have a look at the website, they've got this on the front page, which I found particularly interesting. They're having a look at the key points in traditional education and then contrasting them with what's come in under the so-called progressive banner. But it's one of the parts there is that creativity and feelings are now more important than facts. So we don't want children to know anything about facts. And right and wrong depend on one's point of view. So we've got rid of absolute right or absolute wrong. It just depends what point of view you have, which side of the story you want to focus on.
We're in a post-truth world, Brian.
Absolutely. So I encourage you to have a look at this. And this is a little bit of the website's explanation as to what they're looking at. Whereas the traditionalist believes that the purpose of education is to pass on a body of knowledge, factual and cultural, to future generation, the progressive believes that the purpose of education is to change attitudes and values to construct a politically correct, secular, socialist society. Progressives give particular attention to English history and RE because these subjects have enormous cultural importance. So this is, I think, pretty accurate stuff. And I'm just going to bring in this lady who is involved with that organisation. She has written a very good article as a teacher on what's actually happening in our schools and to the children. David, I'm sure that you recognise this type of education because it's not only in England and Wales, but it's also north of the border and becoming very pernicious.
Very much so. And it goes back a long way. This comes from the Leipzig school. This comes from operant conditioning. It's come in via German universities, and then it was picked up in the United States by people like John Dewey, and it was then imported into England and finally into Scotland. And there was a long attack on Scottish education that lasted the whole of the 19th century and well into the 20th century in the aftermath. It's been beautifully written about in a book called The Democratic Intellect and Crisis, a follow-up called Crisis of the Democratic Intellect, that shows how a long war has been waged against real education. It's a very interesting area, and it's hugely important.
David, thank you for that, because you've given a perfect introduction to the next slide, which we'll just call up on the screen. And we've got Thomas Schumann here. Now, this table I've referred to many times, but because now we've got something to focus on, that education, I've brought it in once again. This particular table was in Christopher Story's book, The EU Collective Enemy of Its Member States. But Thomas Schumann, who was essentially a defector from the Soviet Union, he'd worked as an informant for the KGB, said there's a plan to undermine Western societies, and this was the plan. So if we bring it up on screen, we see that religion and education featured top of that, very interesting in relation to the comments from that charity concerned about education. Religion, we've got politicised, commercialised, make it a form of entertainment, leaving a sort of death wish. But education there, permissiveness, relativity, and the objective was to create ignorance. Every other section of society attacked there. And after initial demoralisation, the aim, he said, was for destabilisation for a period of up to 5 years, followed by crisis, chaos, violence on the streets, and normalisation. Now, normalisation doesn't mean things going back to normal. That means the new society coming in. But I was intrigued when I had a look at the YouTube clip, encouraged people to listen to the talk Thomas Schumann gave about subversion. One of the comments underneath was well ahead of the others, because they said Yuri is correct, but I fear the levels of conspiracy are much deeper than he mentions. Research who funded the Bolshevik Revolution and who gave the Soviets nuclear and space technology. So what this person is pointing out is that if you think that the tactics have come straight out of the Soviet Union, that's not the case. They've come from a far deeper agenda. And you've touched on that, David, by talking about the respective schools. Germany featured in this, and the Frankfurt School is one of the key ones of those. This lady, Julia Reisman, she's also been warning for a great many years in America about how the minds of school children are being attacked. She's written some really excellent books, of which Sexual Sabotage is a very key one, pointing out the dangers of Kinsey and what was going on with his studies into children and the sexualization of children. And if you haven't come across it before, have a look at the Tavistock Institute, where many people say a lot of this social policy is being bred. And to bring it back onto what David's been talking about, this is the key part of it, that the Frankfurt School, and we're going back to the late 1800s, late 1860s, late 1800s, where psychologists and early psychiatrists were coming together to work on the mind of the average human being. And it's this mentality which has then morphed across into the Tavistock Institute and the World Health Organization. And the central document there is a 1940s document where Colonel Rees is saying that we can completely transform society by simply changing the way people think. And he called that mental hygiene. The point we need to bring in is who's been paying for all this. I've been a bit cheeky by putting in the logo of the International Bank of the Bank of International Settlements. But of course, what we do know is the big money, banking money, has helped drive this whole agenda. David, this is very dangerous stuff. This policy is now coming straight through into our civil service, and it's becoming policy on the ground without ever being discussed in Westminster.
This is exactly the point. It's all secret. We see this in microcosm in Scotland with the policies that are introduced into the Scottish Parliament. We wonder, well, where did they come from? And after much digging, it goes back to the World Health Organization or the World Bank or some other globalist organization. It's not coming from the people, certainly not coming from the Parliament, and it's nowhere discussed. So it's all secret.
Okay, David, we'll end on this one. I think this is an opinion piece by Louise Tickle in The Guardian, and the headline is "Charlie Gard's case shows why our family courts must lift their secrecy." And I thought, it's raising many of the issues that over the years we have been raising. Louise Tickle talks about going into a family court case where children were being or had been taken away from their parents. And the secrecy surrounding that. So what were your thoughts on it?
Well, I thought it was excellent. I would encourage people to go and read this. It was quite outstandingly good for The Guardian, which is normally sort of crippled by a particular political viewpoint that prevents them seeing problems in these areas, but not in this case. It's a first-class piece. The final paragraph is worth just reading out. She writes, "I have yet to come across any function of the state that works better in secret. I'm guessing that's why council meetings, parliamentary debates, criminal trials and election counts are all held in public. The law that prevents reporting of what goes on in family courts is meant to protect individual children's interests, but is clearly now working to hide bad and sometimes unlawful social work practice." That's spot on.
But it goes beyond that, Brian, doesn't it? Because it's the corruption is so endemic because of the value of children within the system.
That's absolutely the case. I looked at some statistics, which another, I'm going to say amateur, but I don't mean that unkindly, an amateur organisation working to protect children. And they were talking about a figure of nearly 169,000 children in the care system. And we now know that the moment the state identifies a child to go through the court system or to go into fostering, the initial value of the child is £75,000. If it goes through a prolonged court case, you can add another quarter of a million or even more, plus the salaries and fees of the so-called experts, the psychiatrists or the clinical psychologists, legal fees. And then the value of the child themselves. So fostering, we know that some people are able to get as much as £560 per week per child if the child is normal and healthy. If the child's got any form of special needs, that can climb well over £1,000 per week per child. So we're talking about a vast industry here before we even talk about darker aspects. And I'd just like to say that while you've brought this one in, Mike, I spoke to a young couple yesterday, Brian and Stacey. They have just lost twins. So the twins taken up birth, one twin healthy, the other one still in hospital, I believe. But all of that done with a totally secret system where accusations have been made against the parents without any proper evidence that would normally be required in a proper court in front of a jury. So money is part of it, but this is a vicious and deeply flawed system.
Just to end off on this one then, I mean, you know, juries do get to hear trials where perhaps there's a national security issue involved, and there seems to be less secrecy around national security issues than there is around family court issues. We're not allowed to have juries in family courts.
No.
That in itself has got to end.
Well, the big lie, Mike, has come out in the article, is that they don't want juries, they don't want the public, they don't want the press, because this protects the child. But in fact, the opposite is occurring, that if the public, the mums and dads can't see what's actually happening, this is how the state is stealing children. And there is no doubt that this is what the British state is doing. It is stealing children for profit. And I'm afraid that when we go deeper into investigate what is happening, we're looking for drug experiments. So big pharmaceutical money comes in. And we've also got the extremely harrowing cases where children have lost body parts while they've been in hospital, of which Joan and Derek Bye's story, of course, is one of the key ones. They never got their daughter back. She was returned to them in separate pieces and separate boxes. And the British state has continued to cover up after all the time that's elapsed. So this is a pretty disgraceful thing. Would you like just to end on 30 seconds, David, on that?
Well, I would just reiterate what Mike was saying there, and it's a point that's been made by Ian Josephs as well, that if we want to stop this, it's very straightforward. We change the law, or reintroduce the law as it used to be, where nobody loses a child against their will unless a jury of the peers has considered it correct and right that that be so.
Yeah. Thank you very much for that. Isn't that interesting? We get back onto common law once again. Okay, David, thank you very much for joining us. That brings us to the end of today's UK Column News. I will say, as always, thank you very much to the people who subscribe and donate. If you're still one of the many people we know are watching us because you think that UK Column is providing good news, then please consider subscribing, because we need your financial support to do what we do. And of course, what we would like to do in the very near future is expand the range of the news reporting. That's it from us. We will be back on Monday, same time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.